This week, we dive further into the idea of the ineffable name, the Elohim. Then we take a more objective look at the ineffable word of God. Is it a name, a phrase, an action? What could it mean? And finally, we'll wrap it up with a discussion on a new tarot card draw from a new deck. Stay tuned.
Welcome back to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry. Here's your host, Brother Robert Johnson.
Welcome back to the show. This is episode number 525. As always, on the top of the program, I want to go ahead and thank our contributors, our fellows, and our producers, and our legacy partners. Without you, we cannot make this show, and I thank all of you for allowing us to create such expansive Masonic education and to have it available to all who are interested in Freemasonry and, as Albert Mackey has called it, its kindred sciences. If you're curious on how to assist us in bringing this program to even more people around the world, to spread the light of Freemasonry, arguably that royal art which will enable the human species to move forward, then head on over to WCYpodcast.com and click on Support the Show. First up, Double Eagle Con, December 18th. It's right around the corner. You gotta get your tickets. They're $120 now, I believe. However, here's what you get. 9 speakers and 3 meals, an entire day, and I mean an entire packed day of Masonic education. Michael R. Pohl, Joseph Wages, Roberto Sanchez, Stephen L. Harrison, Chuck Dunning, Brent Morris, Bob Davis, Darren Laners, and Jeffrey Croteau all are going to be at this event at the Scottish Rite Cathedral located in Bloomingdale, Illinois. Head on over to tinyurl.com/DoubleEagleCon2021 and you will then be able to buy your tickets. Ticket sales are going to end likely on the 17th, I believe, but I wouldn't chance getting that close. I would go ahead and pick up your ticket now because it's going to sell out for sure. There is a limited amount of space, and at this time, I think we're getting close to capacity. So if you're waiting, you want to check it out. Again, this is going to be a fantastic event where you're going to get the best speakers in all of Freemasonry in one roof. It's going to be pretty incredible. So again, check this out. Cannot recommend it enough. I will be there. You'll find Brother Scott Duvall will be there as well. Brother Guide Sobecki and so many others will be there. It's going to be an entire day of Masonic education that you're just not going to want to miss. So last week, we got into the topic of the Elohim. And we talked a little bit about kind of objectively what it could be. And we said we would read the second part this week. And we will do just that. But first, I want to read this short piece that comes from the Grand Lodge of Rhode Island. And this is available on rimasons.org. I'll have a link back to it in the show notes, as always. And it's by Roy F. Pruitt. The name of this piece is called The Ineffable Name. One of the most important symbols in Freemasonry is the ineffable or incommunicable name of God. Often called the Tetragrammaton, from the Greek tetra, four, and gramma, letter, because in Hebrew it consists of the four letters, YHWH, and ineffable because it was unlawful to pronounce it. To help the reader understand why the name of God was incommunicable, a brief explanation of the Hebrew language is necessary. The Hebrew alphabet consists entirely of consonants, the vowel always being inserted orally and never written in. The vowel sounds were inserted orally, but only after proper instruction as to the pronunciation of the word. The pious Jew was unable to pronounce any word which had never been before uttered in his presence. Vowel points, as they are called, were invented by the Masoretes, 6 centuries after the Christian era. The name of God, as we pronounce it, is Jehovah, and there is no certainty that is the correct pronunciation. For the oral tradition has been lost to history. Throughout the Old Testament, God is known by I Am, El Shaddai, the Almighty One, Elohim, and other names. But upon Mount Sinai, God communicated to Moses his true name. Thus shalt thou say unto the children of Israel, Jehovah, the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob, hath sent me unto you. This Jehovah is my name forever, and this is my memorial unto all generations. To add to this mysticism, the Kabbalists, by the change of one letter, read the passage as, this is my name forever, but wrote it slightly different, this is my name to be concealed. The Kabbalists, being very meticulous in their writings, it is hard to conceive that they made a mere mistake. In Kabbalah, hidden meanings are often deduced by transposing or reversing letters and writings. Also, a pious Jew will never pronounce the word Jehovah. When read in Scripture, the word is substituted with the word Adonai, or Lord, a practice carried into the English translation of the Bible. In ancient times, there was one person who, it is said, was in possession of the proper pronunciation of the true name of God. This was the high priest, who, after receiving it from his predecessor, would enter the Sanctum Sanctorum, or Holy of Holies of King Solomon's temple, and pronounce it three times, once a year, on the Day of Atonement. If the traditions of Freemasonry are correct, kings had to have possessed a true pronunciation because King Solomon is said to possess the true word and communicated it to Hiram, king of Tyre, and Hiram of Ith. Since times of antiquity, the name of God have been venerated as sacred. The Kabbalists and Talmudists proclaim the mere utterance of God's name shakes heaven and earth and inspires the very angels with terror and astonishment. The rabbis called it Shem HaForish, or in English, the name that is declaratory. It has been said that Freemasonry is not a religion, but Freemasonry is religious. Many of the symbols used in Masonry correspond with the search for divine truth, which is what every Mason searches for in his work and travels. References here go back to the book of the chapter or monitorial instructions of degree work by Albert Mackey, the Holy Bible Book of Exodus, Symbolism of Freemasonry by Mackey, and Explaining the Science and Philosophy of Masonry, and Duncan's Ritual. So here you have a primer on the name of God and its substitutions. One wonders, what are the consequences, other than a philosophical or honorary tradition of not pronouncing the name, is there a very real physical property that happens when the name is pronounced correctly? We may never know. Without further ado, The Elohim Part 2, A Crooked Path. This was published by the same person who published the last article. I'm not really sure of their name because it is somewhat obscured here on the website. However, it was published quite a long time after the first article, almost 2 years. This one came out in May 24th of 2021, and we'll have a link back to it also from the philosophicalsociety.org. The Elohim Part 2, A Crooked Path. In the first section of this article, I introduced the term Elohim and examined a variety of potential explanations for the esoteric and etymological meaning of the word. Their possible connections to the Anunnaki and Shining Ones were also explored. One line of thought is the way religious history unfolded. In earlier days, religious deities appeared to perform a much more prominent role in the interactions with man. As history progresses, however, God's role becomes less discernible, and his hand is harder to see, possibly indicating that his influence becomes more indirect in nature. Along the same lines, I thought of how our own education proceeds. In our early days, as, say, a kindergartner, the teacher's role is very distinct and hands-on. The teacher is close by, invisible at all times. As we progress through schooling, the teacher's role becomes less obvious, until we get into college, where our success or failure is almost exclusively dependent upon our own devices. We enter the workforce with our education in our quiver and make our ways through those mazes, adding to our knowledge completely through our own efforts. Finally, in our twilight years, we can take on the role of a teacher ourselves, imparting that which we have learned through the year. Path of evolution, dominance to peace. A second thought that occurred to me is related to man's perception of God over the centuries. Early on in his history, man was more aggressive and heavily dependent upon brawn for dominance. Similarly, His view, if the gods, was warlike as well. Think about the many stories of the gods from the Greek pantheon, how they seem to constantly be pit against one another, as well as man. As man matured, his belligerent tendencies began to soften, though far from perfect, man is on an improved path, and his view of God evolved similarly. Today, God is seen as an embodiment of peace and goodwill. An interesting contrast presents itself today among people of differing warlike stances. Terrorists tend to view their God as a very direct and confrontational, similar to themselves, whereas those in the Western world tend to view God from a Christian point of view as a primary peacemaker. Using the same logic, it is my belief that those we named fallen angels may not be what we think them to be. Rather, it is possible that those devils may have a specific role to play in man's existence and evolution, one that forms in opposition to the good angels that is very deliberate. Could their purpose have been to propel humanity's evolution by forcing man to recognize and be challenged by his opposite? Evolving leadership, authoritarian to authentic. The general type of leadership most often practiced by the mainstream evolved along comparable lines. In early days, leadership was much more direct and unambiguous. The leader was very evident and authoritarian in nature. He maintained his power through force, if necessary, and it was often the strongest that assumed kingship and other positions of authority. Today, more indirect and subtle forms of leadership are championed. Some examples include servant leadership and authentic leadership. They require the practitioner to embody traits like humility and to learn to read emotions. Overall, I found this research subject to be very satisfying, rewarding, and somewhat surprising. I learned that no line of research should be discounted, however unlikely the topic, and that an unusual topic can lead you down crooked paths to reach unexpected conclusions. So what is interesting about this part is the contemplation of the name led the author down an interesting path of thinking, and it was really interesting to see how this quote-unquote crooked path led him down some additional research to evolving leadership and the way we do leadership today, and the exploration of God as somebody who has almost a reflection of the people to whom that God plays a role. But we don't want to leave it there. So after reading these two pieces, one after another, each in succeeding weeks, you may have thought to yourself, have we read these before? In fact, we have. We read both pieces in episode number 466 of this show, not quite 100 episodes ago. In that particular episode, we also read a piece by Brother T.J. Williams. And I would invite you to check out that episode, and I believe you can skip toward the end to check out that article by T.J. Williams. So for you, right now, I would like to read something a little bit more profound as we think about the ineffable name. This is a little bit of a longer piece. We'll read the first half this week, and we'll finish it next week, which will be our last episode of the year. At the conclusion of that episode, I will also reveal what PDF book I'm going to be sending out to all of our contributors, fellows, producers, and legacy partners, as they have all been helping the show out all year long. I would like to show some gratitude by once again getting you guys a really great OCR'd, searchable PDF of a great Masonic text. And I'll go ahead and have that issued to all of you via email or in the Patreon platform. So keep your eyes open for that. So where episode 466 may have been recapped a little bit last week and a little bit this week, we want to take it that further step. And so we're going to read the full chapter of The Symbolism of Freemasonry, chapter 24, The Ineffable Name. Another important symbol is the ineffable name, with which the series of ritualistic symbols will be concluded. The Tetragrammaton, or ineffable word, the incommunicable name, is a symbol, for rightly considered, it is nothing more than a symbol that has more than any other, except perhaps the symbols connected with the sun worship, pervaded the rites of antiquity, I know, indeed, of no system of ancient initiation in which it has not some prominent form and place. But, as it was, perhaps the earliest symbol which was corrupted by the spurious Freemasonry of the pagans, in their succession from the primitive system of the patriarchs and the ancient priesthood, it will be most expedient for the thorough discussion of the subject which is proposed in the present paper, that we should begin the investigation with an inquiry into the nature of the symbol among the Israelites. That name of God, which we, at a venture, pronounce Jehovah, although whether this is or is not the true pronunciation can now never be authoritatively settled, was ever held by the Jews in the most profound veneration. They derived its origin from the immediate inspiration of the Almighty, who communicated it to Moses as his special appellation, to be used only by his chosen people, and this communication was made at the burning bush, when he said to him, "Thus shalt thou say unto the children of Israel, Jehovah, the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob, hath sent me unto you. This, Jehovah, is my name forever, and this is my memorial until all generations." And at a subsequent period, he still more emphatically declared this to be his peculiar name, "I am Jehovah, and I appeared unto Abraham, unto Isaac, and unto Jacob by the name of El Shaddai. But by my name Jehovah was I not known unto them." It will be perceived that I have not here followed precisely the somewhat unsatisfactory version of King James Bible, which by translating or anglicizing one name and not the other, leaves the whole passage less intelligible and impressive than it should be. I have retained the original Hebrew for both names. El Shaddai, the Almighty One, was the name by which he had before heretofore known to the preceding patriarchs. In its meaning, it was analogous to Elohim, who is described in the first chapter of Genesis as creating the world. But his name of Jehovah was now, for the first time, to be communicated to his people, ushered to their notice with all the solemnity and religious consecration of these scenes and events. This name of God became invested among the Israelites with the profoundest veneration and awe. To add to this mysticism, the Kabbalists, by the change of a single letter, read the passage, "This is my name forever," or as it is in the original, that is to say, "This my name to be concealed." This interpretation, although founded on a blunder, and in all probability an intentional one, soon became a precept, and has been strictly obeyed to this day. The word Jehovah is never pronounced by a pious Jew who, whenever he meets with it in Scripture, substitutes for it the word Adonai or Lord, a practice which has been followed by the translators of the common English version of the Bible, the word Jehovah in the original being invariably translated by the word Lord. The pronunciation of the word being thus abandoned became ultimately lost, as by the peculiar construction of the Hebrew language, which is entirely without vowels, the letters being all consonants, can give no possible indication to one who has not heard it before of the true pronunciation of any given word. To make this subject plainer to the reader who is unacquainted with Hebrew, I will venture to furnish an explanation which will perhaps be intelligible. The Hebrew alphabet consists entirely of consonants. The vowel sounds have always been inserted orally and never marked in writing until the vowel points, as they are called, were invented by the Masoretes some 6 centuries after the Christian era. As the vowel sounds were originally supplied by the reader while reading from a knowledge which he had previously received by means of oral instruction of the proper pronunciation of the word, he was necessarily unable to pronounce any word which he had never heard before in his presence. As we know that DR period is to be pronounced doctor and MR period mister, because we have always heard those peculiar combinations of letters thus enunciated, and not because the letters themselves give any such sound. So the Jew knew from instruction and constant practice, and not from the power of the letters, how the consonants in the different words in daily use were to be vocalized. But, as the 4 letters which compose the word Jehovah, as we now call it, were never pronounced in his presence, but were made to represent another word, Adonai, which was substituted for it, and as the combination of these 4 consonants would give no more indication for any sort of enunciation than the combinations doctor or mister give in our language, the Jew, being ignorant what vocal sounds were to be supplied, was unable to pronounce the word, so that its true pronunciation was in time lost to the masses of the people. There was one person, however, who, it is said, was in possession of the proper sound of the letters and the true pronunciation of the word. This was the high priest, who, receiving it from his predecessor, preserved the recollection of the sound by pronouncing it three times once a year on the Day of Atonement, when he entered the Holy of Holies of the tabernacle of the temple. If the traditions of Masonry on this subject are correct, the kings, after the establishment of the monarchy, must have participated in this privilege, for Solomon is said to have been in possession of the word, and to have communicated it to his two colleagues at the building of the temple. This is the word, which from the number of its letters was called the Tetragrammaton, or four-lettered name, and from its sacred inviolability, the ineffable, or unutterable name. The Kabbalists and Talmudists have enveloped it in a host of mystical superstitions, most of which are as absurd as they are incredible, but all of them tending to show the great veneration that has always been paid to it. Thus they say that it is possessed of unlimited powers, and that he who pronounces it shakes heaven and earth and inspires the very angels with terror and astonishment. The rabbis called it the name that is declaratory, and they say that David found it engraved on a stone while digging into the earth. From the sacredness with which the name was venerated, it was seldom, if ever, written in full, and consequently a great many symbols or hieroglyphics were invented to express it. One of these was the letter, or yud, equivalent nearly to the English I or J or Y, which was the initial of the word, and it was often inscribed within an equilateral triangle, the triangle itself being a symbol of deity. This symbol of the name of God is peculiarly worthy of our attention, since not only is the triangle to be found in many of the ancient religions occupying the same position, but the whole system itself is undoubtedly the origin of the hieroglyphic exhibited in the second degree of Masonry, where the explanation of the symbolism being the same, the form of it, as far as it respects the letter, has only been anglicized by modern innovators. In my own opinion, the letter G, which was used in the fellowcraft degree, should never have been permitted to intrude into Masonry. It presents an instance of absurd anachronism which would never have occurred if the original Hebrew symbol had been retained. But being there now, without the possibility of removal, we have only to remember that it is in fact but the symbol of a symbol. Widely spread, as I have already said, was this reverence for the name of God, and consequently its symbolism. In some peculiar form, it is to be found in all of the ancient rites. Thus, the ineffable name itself, of which we have been discoursing, is said to have been preserved in its true pronunciation by the Essenes, who in their secret rites communicated it to each other only in a whisper and in such form that while its component parts were known, they were so separated as to make the whole word a mystery. Among the Egyptians, whose connection with the Hebrews was more immediate than that of any other people, and where consequently there was a greater similarity of rites, the same sacred name is said to have been used as a password for the purpose of gaining admission to their mysteries. Now, we will continue the rest of this piece next week as the final episode of the year. Before we leave you this week, let's take a look at the tarot. All right, so if you're just joining us for the first time, over the last few weeks, we've begun a segment on the tarot. Now, before you get weirded out and you turn the program off or fast forward through it, know that what we're doing is not divinatory in nature. It's not conjuring, it's not cartomancy or anything else. What we're doing is choosing one random card from a deck of tarot. Week to week, we might change decks to get different perspectives from different authors and different visualizations. But what we're doing is choosing the one card, looking at what they say it means, and then thinking internally about what that card could mean for us in our own lives. For instance, if you got a tower card, which is like revelation, what have you recently thought about that made sense to you? Or things of this nature. And so, keeping with that tradition, this week I'm using a brand new tarot deck that I have just acquired. It's called the Tarot Restless, that comes with a book called Restless Meditations. It is quite an interesting deck in that it is probably not a deck I would recommend anybody under the age of, 16, 17 look at. It is kind of mature in that aspect. I'm just giving the cards a quick shuffle here. Again, as I've mentioned in the past, I have no actual set number of shuffles that I do. This tarot deck is described by the creator as deep, contemplative, and disturbing. Which some of the imagery definitely is, and you'll see whatever card we pull, I will post in the Facebook group, the Craftsman Plus, for your contemplative meditations. The deck itself is 78 cards, as always. It uses the four standard suits, wands, cups, swords, and instead of pentacles or coins or anything like that, it uses stars. So just kind of generic. But here we go. Let's draw a card. So the card I drew was an inversed King of Cups. So let's look at what this card means from this deck creator. Then we can look at kind of the Smith-Waite definition of the inverted card, and then we'll move on to the more objective and practical application of the card. So the author says that the King Thimdral, all Ketheth, upturneth his cup. In the proper upright condition, the card represents honor, leadership, fortitude, uprightness, and difficult passages. Inverted, though, it's criticism of power, wavering faith, and departure. Now, for really the Smith-Waite deck, says that upright, it's emotionally balanced, compassionate, and diplomatic. Reversed, how we drew the card, actually, says self-compassion, inner feelings, moodiness, and emotionally manipulative. Huh. Well, the King of Cups, really, in general, there's a stone around them. Whether the king sits on the stone or not is up to the particular artist. The king holds a cup that really represents emotions. And he sometimes will hold a scepter that is representative of power and control. And unlike some other of the court cards, you'll notice he is not looking at his implement, right? So in this card, he's not looking directly at the cup. He's focused on something else, which means maybe he's already mastered this emotional self, which, again, the cup represents emotions, so if he's not looking at it, he's really not thinking about that so much. So maybe he's acting out of something else, acting not in an emotional fashion. But if he's inversed, maybe he is acting on emotions more than normal. The King of Cups reversed might indicate that we are thinking too much, that we are thinking about our innermost feelings. What could we be thinking about? Perhaps we are becoming more aware of our feelings this time of year, maybe? You might be thinking or even discovering some of the emotions that you have in your subconscious and thinking about how those subconscious thoughts might be affecting you in your waking mind, in your day-to-day goings-on. The card also stands for like this emotional stability. So if it's inversed, it might be telling us that are we reacting appropriately, or are we getting too upset with, you know, goings-on in the family and drama? Maybe not so surprising this time of year is, you know, the holidays do bring upon us a certain amount of stress and anxiety in a lot of cases. So this could be indicative of telling us, hey, let's be aware of our own anxieties and emotions in this holiday season and not get too caught up in the family drama or friends drama, whatever it could be. And lastly, it also may indicate that you're beating yourself up about something. Perhaps there's something in your life that you've just been going over all the time and thinking about how you could have, quote-unquote, done a better job. And this might not be completely accurate. You need to be able to give yourself self-compassion, to forgive yourself for things. You're not giving yourself your due credit. For a Craftsman Plus, I'd like to know, in this upcoming holiday season, what is something that has been stressful for you? What is something that is a stressor for you? It could be all year, it could be at the holiday season, but what is something that is a stressor for you? And lastly, if you feel comfortable enough, tell us something that you've been beating yourself up over, that you know you should be more compassionate to yourself about. That's it for this week. I hope you all have enjoyed. We'll talk to you all again next week when we finish out this article or chapter, rather, as well as dive into some other new areas of Freemasonry. One more time, I want to thank you all for listening, and I want to give a special thanks to our contributors, fellows, producers, and legacy partners of the program. Without you, we cannot make this show. And if you want to learn more about it, head on over to WCYpodcast.com, click on Support the Show, and see how you can help. And lastly, go to tinyurl.com/DoubleEagleCon2021 to get your tickets for the most incredible education event of 2022. We waited all year to bring it to you, and here it is. It's coming up. It's right around the corner. I'll be there. Scott Duvall will be there. Darren Lehners will be there. Plus, not to mention all of our presenters, which are just incredible individuals, the top Masonic names in the United States. It's going to be amazing. Check it out. Again, tinyurl.com/DoubleEagleCon2021 and get your tickets. With that, I'll talk to you all next week. Till then, stay on the level for Whence Came You. I'm Robert Johnson. Take care.
You've been listening to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry with your host, Brother Robert Johnson. Be sure to join us for our next edition.